Om ugen han arbejder man måske 60-70. Og så er det så spørgsmålet, om man skal tælle meditationen med i det, synes I det? Men så nu en spirituel lærer, ikke så meditationen en del af arbejde, eller hvordan er det nu, det foregår? Jeg spørger mig selv nogle gange. Men når man er sådan der, underviser i meditation og spiritualitet generelt, så er det også nogle gange lidt krævende at rejse, fordi man skal altid være på toppen, når man kommer. Men det kan også være hårdt arbejde at rejse meget med forskellig mad og temperatur og mange nye mennesker hele tiden. Så Robert spurgte, om man nu er spirituel underviser, om man har sådan et enkelt, let liv, når man rejser rundt og bare holder foredrag. Men i virkeligheden så er det mange andre ting, der foregår bag ved sin hele tiden. Man skal følge med på sin e-mail, og der er mange mennesker, der spørger om masser ting, og mange mennesker, som har stor tilliden. Så det er faktisk en ret krævende stilling at have som sådan. Vi er lige kommet fra en retreat på Åland. Ved du, hvor Åland ligger? Det er sådan en ø mellem Sverige og Finland. Og der har vi haft en retreat for alle centrene i Skandinavien, så vi kom derfra i går, og sen holdt Charlie et foredrag i Stockholm i går aftes, og sen så her i aften. Og på den her retreat på Åland, så har vi talt rigtig meget om kærlighed. Charlie, han siger, meditation, det er at åbne sig for den højeste kærlighed. Han siger, at spiritualitet, det er at have et kærligt forhold til sig selv. Og at når man bliver negativ, det er mangel på kærlighed i forskellige former. Så jeg glæder mig til at høre, hvad han har at sige om kærlighed og følelser i aften. Vi tænkte introducere et lille nyt element. Jeg har bringet sådan en lille klokke fra Småland. Kan alle høre den? Så indimellem, når klokken ringer, så tænkte vi, så stopper vi og mediterer lidt. Et minut bare. Og blive stille. Det er rigtig godt at træne på det her med at blive stille. Så når klokken ringer, så tager vi et minut stille her. Så kan man prøve at holde fast i en positiv tanke, og så sidde og holde den et stykke tid. Og Charlie ved heller ikke, hvornår jeg vil ringe på klokken. You don't know either how often or when I will ring the bell. But when I ring the bell, we can go quiet for a minute. And then I ring the bell again, then it's time to continue. It's an experiment. Is that okay with you? Because we don't have anything else tonight. We don't have any film for you. We don't have any song for you. But we have Charlie, and that's very nice. And we have the little bell. Okay? Thank you. And welcome, Charlie.
Thank you.
You didn't understand that, but I told him beforehand what I would say. Yeah. I told them you talked about love on the retreat. And I'm very interested to hear what you have to say about feelings tonight. And also said it's not an easy, always just easy to be traveling so much and managing so many centers. Okay, welcome.
So, thank you very much, Sonia, for that lovely introduction, though I didn't understand any of it. It's very, very special for me to be here tonight in this beautiful hall, and I must admit I'm feeling a bit like a talk show host or something like that. what I'd like to do tonight is just share a few of my thoughts, and there will be a little bit of time for some questions, some discussion. And I think, as you know, we always love to finish with some experience, some meditation. I think, as you heard during the introduction, I'm actually based in Sydney. And some years ago, I was invited to teach meditation at the main prison in Sydney. And what they'd done, they'd set up a special little unit within the prison. And it was like an experiment to encourage prisoners to behave better, if I can say that. And they'd set up a point system. And if you did behave well, if you did the right things, you collected points. If you did the wrong things, you lost points. And so they were encouraging, were giving them benefits like watching television, etc., things like this. And so I went there one day, and there was 15 prisoners in this little unit, and all of them turned up for the meditation. And I thought, isn't that wonderful? You know, they're so interested in meditation. But I found out later they actually got points for coming to meditation. So there was an incentive to be there. But actually what I remember was there was one man who, a very, very big man, who spoke very passionately one day. He was an incredibly intelligent and articulate person. And he shared his story really about his life, his career, but how powerful emotions had influenced him. And he was saying that when he gets angry, he gets in such a rage that he doesn't even remember what he does. And he killed someone, he murdered someone and went to prison. And in prison, he murdered another person. He was there for life. And he was just, you know, an incredibly intelligent person, but so deeply confused, I can say, about how to deal with the power of emotion. It's something all of us have to deal with. I don't think quite as strong as his. But we all know the power of these feelings. And some of these emotions are very visible, like anger and aggression. They're the explosive types. But the majority of emotion I often call implosive, you know? It's silent, but I would say just as powerful. Emotions such as fear and guilt, depression, these sorts of emotions, very powerful emotions, but perhaps more silent than the very expressive ones. And I think emotions can be very positive and be so uplifting spiritually. But the negative emotions can be so destructive to almost all aspects of my life. And we all know that the effect, for instance, of that most visible form of emotion, I often call it the end point of emotion, which is anger. We all know its effect on relationships. That when I'm angry, you know, sometimes I think we all have a little digital camera, you know, in our forehead, and we sort of take a picture of a scene of life, which is like an indelible impression in my inner world. And when someone gets really angry, it's like I go click, 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 and it's stored on the hard disk of your memory. And each time you come in front of them, you're a bit, whoa, you know? How many times do I have to behave in a peaceful way to convince somebody that this isn't going to happen once again? I'm sure tonight, if I was to throw a tantrum up here now, I'm sure the one thing you'd remember about this evening was the tantrum that I threw. Actually, the founder of the Brahma Kumaris Spiritual University used to say that if you're angry, people will remember it for at least 6 months. And so it's like the carelessness, the lack of control in just a few seconds influences my life for such a long time. Not just relationships, even my health. And I think there's so much fascinating research today linking my emotional state with my physical health. You know, there's some recent research that says that when we let go of anger in the form of a grudge, you know, when you hold a grudge against somebody, that when we let it go, it can relieve back pain. This actually scientific research, which I find really quite fascinating. Back pain is one of the most common physical ailments as far as I'm aware. Not only that, that anger has an effect on my memory and even my heart. When I'm regularly very angry, there's cell atrophy. In other words, it kills cells and there's memory loss. And even the heart, every time we get angry, blood sugar, blood pressure goes up, arteries harden, and it's even going to affect my heart. It's just extraordinary, the relationship between powerful emotions with my relationships with my health, and I would say even probably mostly my relationship with me. You know, my life experience, I think we're extremely sensitive to my own behavior. I find if I'm in any way angry or disrespectful towards someone, deep down, how do you feel about yourself? Really deep down. On the surface, I may justify it, but deep down, there's a little bit of disappointment that I'm not behaving really according to my highest values. And I feel that emotions, you know, sometimes I'm amazed how powerful they are. Because the millisecond, the instant I feel the power of anger or fear or whatever it may be, it's almost like I bow down and allow that emotion to take over my inner world. You know how that happens. And that vessel of reason, that vessel of wisdom, which usually regulates my thinking, which is my intellect, is bulldozed by the emotion. You know, the rational part is just pushed aside, and it's almost like you've got a foreign power in your inner world. Sometimes I think it's like we have our kingdom, our inner kingdom of our thoughts and our feelings, but there's a foreign power that's invaded and taken over and is dictating what is happening. I don't know whether you've ever observed when you wake up one morning and you think, well, you know, sometimes relationships are challenging in the family or at work. I think today, you know, I really want to put my better self forward, you know, to really express love, be peaceful. And with, you know, within 3 minutes and 20 seconds, I'm, you know, really. And do you ever wonder who's really ruling inside? Who's really in charge in my inner world? It seems I'm so vulnerable to so many of these feelings. And sometimes perhaps the rational part of me says, don't worry, there's nothing to be worried about. Don't react. You know how that rational part will speak to you, but the irrational part can kick in so quickly. And often it's the irrational part that wins that sort of dialogue between two parts of me. But I think what I find fascinating in our world is that so much of our focus is external, you know, about our career, our life, and yet each one of us here has to deal with a mind that can create up to 50,000 unique thought patterns in a day, and an emotional world internally. Does anyone ever tell you what to do? Is it just that we find our own way? In all other aspects of life, usually, you know, we have a clear education. But it seems that this is just something we have to navigate. And I think what we tend to do is find our own strategies for dealing with incredibly powerful feelings, whether they're anger, whether they're fear, whether they're hurt, whether it's grief, whatever is the strength of that emotion. And I think probably the main way that we deal with emotion is to suppress it. Because it looks pretty ugly, doesn't it, if I just blah in front of people. It's not an attractive thing at all. And so what do I do with these feelings? The usual way is I push them down. I push my anger down. I push my grief down. I push my hurt down. But it does emerge somewhere. Perhaps overreaction, frustration. But I think what we're learning, it can often reemerge in my physical well-being and my health. And perhaps another strategy that we develop is denial, you know. I think we're become amazing experts at self-denial. I don't know whether you agree. You know, once I was working in a kitchen and there was one guy, one of the people working there, and he had a sort of, I don't know exactly what happened, but he got pots and pans and he threw them all around the kitchen. You know, he was so disturbed, upset. And when he cooled off, I just went to say, are you okay? Is everything okay? And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, just what happened then with the pots and pans? He said, nothing happened. I'm quite serious. And I said to somebody, I can't believe it. And apparently it's even a psychological condition that it's almost like we put a delete button to certain things of my own behavior because I don't like it and yet I have no control. And so it's like this incredible ability to deny to the self. In Australia, we run meditation classes for people with addiction. And I think many of you know that wonderful program called the 12-Step Program, which is a very, very powerful program for people with any type of addiction. And you know, the first step, the first and often the hardest step is to admit I have a problem. And once that's there, then often healing can begin, that process of healing. So sometimes I suppress, sometimes I deny, sometimes I even avoid situations that press my buttons of emotion. You know how we know certain personalities and certain situations make me feel comfortable? So I develop a designer life. You know a designer life where we just avoid things that can trigger those powerful feelings inside of me. Sometimes I even come on the front foot with another strategy where I begin to justify my powerful emotions, especially anger and hurt, that you are the problem and you have to change. And blame. You know, in my spiritual journey, and all of us are on our own spiritual journey, sometimes I feel that the ultimate state of ignorance is to blame. When I'm blaming, it's like that's the farthest point from truth. I'm in this incredible world of self-deception where I'm saying that if you change, I'm going to be okay. If everything else around me changes, I'll be okay. I'm abdicating all sense of responsibility for my inner world. Or sometimes, you know, in these strategies of how to manage our emotions, that we just let it all hang out, you know. And I, in the 1960s and 70s, early 70s, I was living in London at the time. And the latest fashion, I would say, in sort of psychiatry, you know, psychiatry and psychology, was there's so much suppression in us, just let it out, you know. And often patients were encouraged just to express any feeling, etc. It was a disaster. And at that time, I think in corporate Japan, they developed, you know, a system where they'd have a little room in the office. Do you remember this? I think it was about 20, 30 years ago. And if someone was feeling a bit frustrated, a bit negative, you know, they would walk peacefully down into this room, and there was dummies there wearing suits and ties, and they just, you know, let it all out and then walk peacefully back to the office and continue. So all these weird strategies which we develop, but ultimately a part of the spiritual journey is this wonderful sense of sitting with myself, my own truth, and reflecting on who I am, what sort of feelings are embedded deeply in me, and beginning to gently work with my own self-awareness and my own truth to deal with some of these feelings which sometimes just sit there and are never healed. And I feel really the first step on this journey is, you know, to understand these emotions and take responsibility for them. Because, you know, the emotion of anger it's quite a scary emotion. It's quite scary. I often think of it. It's quite powerful, isn't it, to stop and just when I was, you know, about just make a point. But you know, this emotion of anger, I often feel like a volcano. And you know, it explodes, the volcano. But for years and years, it's been boiling and rumbling underneath, you know? Once I was in Costa Rica, and there was a recently erupted volcano, and I walked up to the lip and looked down, and right in the bottom of the volcano was this bubbling, frothing, iridescent green water, just, you know, really quite incredibly active. And I think it's like us, because sometimes we've got to look what is underneath the anger. What is feeding this feeling, which most of us feel so strongly? Sometimes it's fear. Sometimes it's fear that my vulnerability will be exposed. Fear that people will see that I'm not so confident. I don't have so much self-love. Or sometimes it is even grief. That in my life I feel I haven't been loved in the way I should have been. Or hurt. Deep hurt at the way I feel I've been treated. If this is, you know, going and going for year in, year out, at some point, you know, it's like anger is the end point. And I think, you know, spiritually approaching these emotions, it's like at some point to sit and begin to see what is the seed of my anger. I think one of the most powerful steps on this journey is to be honest with myself, just open, without projecting it on anyone else. What is the seed of this feeling? What is the hurt? What's the grief? What's the fear that is feeding this feeling? Because sometimes I feel the first law of spirituality is that I am responsible for how I feel. I am responsible for how I feel. There is absolutely no doubt. People do behave badly. People are abusive. But ultimately, the emotion or the feeling I create is my choice. Because only when I take responsibility for this, that it is my feeling, it is my hurt, it is my grief, do I even begin to step on the path of dealing with these very powerful emotions. And I feel that, you know, the second step is to really begin to know myself. And you know how language becomes fashionable? I think, you know, the way we use language, and some of the fashionable language these days is, you know, IQ, EQ, and SQ, you know. And the way I see it is we have those three forms of wisdom. Intellectual ability, very important, helps me understand the world around me, helps me develop a career, make money. But when I feel anxious, when I feel upset, when I feel hurt, does that intelligence help? I don't think very much at all. The second type of wisdom, essential for life, is that emotional intelligence, which some people have this innate ability to tune into others, know how to respond. The wisdom to just build and sustain loving, really loving, rich relationships. Such an incredible ability. But if there is conflict, I'm not sure really even this wisdom helps so much. To me, spiritual intelligence is that part of my wisdom which is least developed. If emotional intelligence is the wisdom to establish loving, rich relationships with others, spiritual intelligence is the wisdom to develop a rich, loving relationship with myself, to actually begin to know who I am deeply. I often feel the first relationship in life is with me, And if that relationship is dysfunctional, it pollutes everything. Not just my relationships with you, my health, absolutely everything. I feel, to be very honest, it's this relationship that's producing this dysfunctional society which we have everywhere. Because there's so much dysfunction in how I feel about myself. And I feel when we have this dysfunctional relationship with self, it's the parent of these negative emotions. You know, if I, my self-talk is, you're an idiot, you're stupid, people don't like you, no one loves you. And, you know, we don't speak to ourselves all the time like that, but an incredible amount of self-talk is very, very negative. And that chronic negative self-talk becomes like parents so many of these negative emotions. And that's why I would say the healing process begins by re-establishing a relationship with my intrinsic and true self. But when I reflect on this, I see that in all of us there's like three personalities which are working. And I would say two of them feed all the negative emotional stuff, and one of them becomes the seed to grow, I would say, my original or natural or positive feelings and emotions. The first personality in us, I call the facade I present to the world. You know that image we have, we present to life? I call it the eye of arrogance or the eye of superiority. And this eye has a whole thinking, feeling structure. I think, I know more, I am right, maybe I am better. This is the eye that will pick fault in others and always compares. But when it's ruling in my inner system and it trickles into my feelings, when this is ruling, that's when I feel so easily insulted, disrespected, not valued, excluded, sensitive. How much do we feel those emotions in a day? And often we usually project it onto you. And yet in a way, my ego is deceiving me. My ego has taken sovereignty in my inner system, and it's deceiving me. And this eye begins to think, I'm fine, you're the problem. You know that eye? Maybe you don't know that eye. I'm okay, you're the one who has to change, you know? So disconnected from who I really am and my truth. So this eye is very powerful, but probably that's the eye of superiority, the eye of arrogance, but it's a cover for the second eye, which is the vulnerable eye. And you know, behind the confident me is that not so confident me. I think we all know that internally, that self-doubt that sits there. I call this one the eye of inferiority or the eye of lack of self-respect. This eye thinks others are better, others are right, others know more. Others won't accept me, others won't respect me, others won't love me. And when it starts to trickle into my emotions and feelings, that's when I feel hopeless about myself, inadequate, inferior, unworthy, and I would even say depressed, which is the new buzzword today. You know, sometimes I feel there's like a crisis in the soul of humanity. And when it bubbles to the surface, we call it stress or tension. The latest word is depression. And recently in Australia, I went on a speaking tour with a guy who wrote a book about depression. And he got a lot of famous people in that country to share their story of dealing with depression. And he quotes the World Health Organization that one in four of us is suffering from depression. I didn't know. No one can statistically say accurately. But that's an epidemic, isn't it? It says to me there's something so fundamentally wrong with the whole approach to life. Psychologically, depression is like a sadness, a deep sadness that my dreams in life to be loved, to be accepted, to be valued haven't been met. But spiritually, depression is like a mourning. When someone dies, you mourn. It's a mourning for the loss of my true identity. I'm living my life, but who am I? And often, you know, this, the eye of arrogance often has explosive emotions. You know, when I feel insulted, disrespected, very angry, very hurt. The eye of lack of self-respect, the eye of inferiority, the implosive. Often grief and sadness and all these sorts of things. And often we fluctuate, we go between the two. And this is where spiritually the third eye is re-establishing with the permanent eye. These two eyes are very temporary, and they're the seeds of a lot of negative emotion. And the original eye begins to think, who am I? I am a soul. The soul is just a point. A point exists but has no physical size. It's incredible. I, the soul, I think Sonia's watching me when I get really sort of hyped up to a point. She gets out her little bell and and rings it. Now, I, the soul, and to me this is the most beautiful internal journey of re-self-discovery. The eternal self, the immortal self, this point source of energy. A point exists but has no physical size. No length, breadth, or width. The soul is something so subtle. And as I begin this amazing journey, which is the first step in meditation, to reconnect with my permanent self, that I start, my own experience when I began to meditate was like you come home to a place in yourself which is so comfortable, you know? A place where you don't have to be anything. You know, you don't have to impress anybody. You don't have pressure on yourself to look good, you know. That all that stuff that we often are dealing with, you just are. I'm just being in that sweet place. Because I think if I sow the seed of the true self, not the false or temporary self, which is the only, the you know, my physical sense of introduction, it starts to grow the seed of original emotion. The natural consequence when you're in that state of self-realization is the feeling of peace. It's a natural byproduct. I often say to people, the aim of meditation is not, the aim of meditation is not to be peaceful. That's the result. The aim of meditation is to realize the permanent self. The automatic byproduct is the feeling of a genuine internal, deep and sweet feeling of inner peace, which not only affects my mind, but my physical organs as well. And so, in this journey of emotion, dealing with them, it's almost like If I sow the seed of ego, if I sow the seed of lack of self-respect, it's constantly going to produce these negative emotions. If I sow the seed of the self as the soul, it's starting to produce positive emotions. And I would say, my own feeling, it's just my view, I don't even think you have to analyze why all these negative emotions come. The more I bring out my original feelings of being peaceful, of being loving, it seems to have power to reduce the effect of the negative stuff. But thirdly, I think the experience of true love is such a powerful thing for dealing with powerful emotions, because one of the most powerful emotions is grief. And many of you would know Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Do you know Elizabeth Kubler-Ross? That amazing American woman who spent a life sort of researching grief. One of my close friends in Australia, who's a medical doctor, went to one of her workshops. It was a life-changing experience for him. And I won't go into all the details, but she feels all of us have a lot of suppressed grief inside of us. And during this workshop, and Roger, I think, would tell you himself, he's English and he's pretty, you know, a bit stiff. Anyway, this emotion came out because when he was 10, he had a little sister die of cot death, and all this stuff came out. And Elizabeth Kubler-Ross came over and just sat with him and listened to him and was very, very compassionate and understanding, but finally said, but that's not the real grief. She said, the real grief is that at some point we turned away from perfect love. True love, which she felt was the relationship with the true lover of the soul, which is God. And then each time we lose someone or something, it opens up that wound that's sitting there, that at some point we lost this connection with perfect love. And I think sometimes for me, I feel the subtext of life is this search to find love. And we invest our heart in relationships. You think, each one of us here, how much have you given to your family? How much? We give everything, which is so natural and normal, but there's that huge human dilemma that no relationship is permanent. And this has created another very powerful negative emotion of insecurity, this incredible insecurity that can sometimes take over and make me feel so fearful about so many things happening around me, especially with my sources of love, if I can use that. And this is why something I love about spirituality, because spirituality is really, I often feel that there's three sources of love. There's me, my family, my friends, and God. And I would say today that from me, not so much love comes, because that relationship generally is quite dysfunctional. From God, well, we're not sure about that. We've go through, you know, what's all that about? That's a big question. I mean, in my life, I've been an atheist, an agnostic, and now very much I have a relationship with God, but I've, you know, been through it all. And I'm sure many of us here have too. The one source of love, my family, my friends. If there's conflict, if there's a loss, it's like my whole world is thrown up into so much upheaval. Spirituality is strengthening the first two relationships of life, the permanent relationship with myself as a soul, and the one relationship that's permanent with the Supreme Soul. And when that platform is there, I think it's such a solid platform to build other things in my life. For me, when I sit to meditate, and I do it every single morning of my life, I never miss wherever I am, I just sit so simply, and I love to let go, let go, let go, and become the soul. Just sit here in the forehead so lightly. And then through the eye of the mind, I focus on this light here. And it's not that I'm meditating on a concept, a philosophical belief system. It's like a relationship with a lover, a real living soul. It's not just a point of theory. It's too dry. There's actually, I'm connecting with a real soul. And this relationship is a thought away. This relationship is permanent. And often I feel that that soul, if I can use the expression, is on the FM wavelength, you know, when you're on the radio, the FM. When I'm body conscious, when I'm indulged in my ego and lack of self-respect, ego of superiority, ego of inferiority, I'm on the AM dial. Sure, I can believe in something, but when I become soul conscious, it's like I go up to the same frequency. I go up to the FM dial, and that relationship is something so real and absolutely intrinsic to the feeling of true love, a love which is so clean and so pure. And I really feel, as Elizabeth Kubler-Ross said, we have a memory of a quality of love that is so pure. That power, I think, that experience of love is a huge step towards cooling my inner world. And even another step, I think that, you know, when we sort of are talking about our feelings and dealing with them, this probably they're so enmeshed with my relationships with others. And you know, in our meditation centers around the world, I've had the fortune to visit many of them. And I find no matter which part of the world, scratch the surface of almost any person, there's such a history, such a story about how I feel in terms of my relationships. The way I'm looking at it these days is that as a soul, my whole history is sitting in my subconscious. You know, we perform actions and the actions leave impressions and we carry, it's like I'm sitting here now in the present, but all my behaviors, my actions, are sitting, they're recorded in my subconscious. All sorts of feelings and emotions. When someone comes in front of me, their presence, their opinions, their vibrations, their face trigger feelings inside me. They're an instrument to reveal to me who I am, what's sitting in my subconscious. The soul with wisdom takes responsibility. They're my feelings. But if we don't have wisdom, what do? We project onto you. Sure, there is no doubt people behave badly. People do all sorts of things. But ultimately, those feelings have been created in my inner world. So I have to take responsibility. And I think that when we begin to take that responsibility and start to deal with my own feelings, I feel the greatest influence in any relationship is not so much what we say, it's who I am. You know, whenever you communicate with another person, and 90% of the effect of that communication is nonverbal. That's common knowledge. It's amazing, isn't it? And often you think, what will I say? What will I say? But that only affects 10%. And when you get two messages, one is what you hear and one is what you feel. We always trust our feelings, you know? We are working on that feeling level. As I meditate, as I clean out my inner world, as I improve my self-respect, as I begin to work with my emotions, my vibrations become lighter and people get a good feeling from me. And that's where I feel that everyone today has stuff, everyone has weakness. And if I tune into the good in people, if I have the self-respect to do that, it's a massive step to improving the quality of life. And I feel these days that the most powerful leader, all they have to do to me is hold the value of the people around them in their attitude. You know, if we have the strength to know the value of people, yes, they have their stuff, their weakness, their rubbish, but they have their good. If I choose to focus on that, human nature is to rise when we're appreciated, and almost automatically it starts to work with the negative. It's like children. Children work best when we appreciate them and we love them, but I think adults do too. And so I think that, you know, when we start to really recognize the power of these emotions and take responsibility for them, I think what works these days on the spiritual journey, like when I started on my journey, it was the 1970s. And, you know, sometimes I think, you know, meditation became popular because the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, you know, they meditate. So it's sort of like a hobby, you know, you meditate. Okay. I think that, you know, in those days, perhaps we could say meditation, a spiritual lifestyle was, you know, a bit fashionable, a bit like a hobby. We did it when we felt like it. In the 1980s, the whole sort of stress thing came along, and people took up a spiritual practice or meditation on a regular basis, like a discipline. You know, like you do exercise, you keep a meditation practice going. What I've observed today is that what really works is when I make it as a lifestyle, meaning that within my life as it is now, I put a little structure to sustain myself, to work with my own unique set of emotions that sometimes disturb me, and on a regular basis, just with my meditation practice, perhaps my spiritual study, I move forward towards becoming the person I really want. Because I think that more than ever, people really do want to connect with true self, take responsibility for our inner world, but we need that little structure. I think I often feel our learning, we learn by just collecting information. We know so much information. But spiritual education is such a different thing. I think it's taking one idea and just going deeper and deeper and deeper. In a sense, the idea, who am I am a soul, is a lifelong learning. And this is really what spirituality is. I do this like laboratory of my mind. I explore deeply. And each day I'm just pushing it further. And it becomes this wonderful sort of journey of self-discovery. And I think that spirituality is about transformation. I was talking with a friend of mine recently, and we're saying that for I would say many hundreds of years, consciously or unconsciously, religion taught us to suppress a lot. You know, I was always talking about wonderful things up here. And because of that, psychology was born, however many years ago. How long was it? 100, 150 years. Because to be honest about the dark side of the self and these dark feelings that emerge. But sometimes, you know, psychology can just, we can just analyze and analyze and analyze, you know, to an extreme degree. You indulge in this sort of self-analysis of all the stuff that's gone wrong forever. But spirituality, I think, is being honest. Yes, that's good. But putting all my focus into changing myself with the power of knowing who I am and the relationship with God. And I really feel when those two bits are in place and I feel the connection with the Supreme Soul, I think it's almost like we take back my own power. Many times I've observed my mind, what triggers thoughts. Because I love the idea on the spiritual journey that you have this gentle observation of self. And I think most of our thoughts are just reactions. Someone says something, I think. I observe something, I hear the news, think. I remember something of the past, think, you know? Just reacting. What's happening when I meditate? When I meditate, I'm sitting down and I'm feeding my mind the thoughts I want. I'm actually taking back internal control. And I'm deciding which thoughts I want and which feelings I'm creating. So rather than my mind just constantly reacting to life, I'm educating myself to create the thoughts and feelings I want. And if I have that much self-love, and I believe it's that, I'll do it on a daily basis. And to me, that's the way it works. We live in an incredibly uncertain, unpredictable world. Anything can happen. The more I invest in my own internal strength, I think the more I'm equipping myself for all the eventualities which can, you know, possibly happen. So anyway, I've been going on for quite a while, and Sonia hasn't given me the bell for a few minutes. So before she does, I thought I would get in first. Yeah, if you have any questions or comments you would like to make, we have a few minutes, and then we'll have a little bit of meditation before we go. So please feel free if anyone would like to ask something. She is an interesting person.
It's just that I think in this country, that means Europe, she's known as a near-death, somebody who really investigated near-death experiences.
And I'm so sorry, I can't hear clearly, I'm sorry.
What I'm saying is that Kubler-Ross is known here in Denmark, and I think in Europe, as someone who has investigated near-death experiences. You get my point? Near-death experience.
I'm sorry, I can't hear.
You cannot hear?
Mm. She has investigated near-death.
Yes, thank you. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear. Yes, she's done a lot of investigation, fascinating investigation in near-death experiences, yes.
That's
sorry, it's a bit hard. I'm not sure whether it's the vibrations. I just can't hear clearly.
He's saying you're welcome to comment on her work on near-death experiences because it's so close to her work and grief.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. I apologize. yes, I've actually worked with a man in Australia too who he's made a number of films about the journey of the soul, near-death experiences and reincarnation. In fact, I think he's made more films than almost anyone in the world on these subjects, and I think absolutely fascinating, because the soul, we just use that name, but it's an overname for three aspects of consciousness: the mind, and the mind receives the information from the five senses. So as we go about life, what we see, what we hear, what we taste is thrown up on the screen of my mind. The intellect is that faculty of assessment or judgment. You know, all the information, there's a part of you constantly assessing the information. As I've been speaking, a part of you has constantly been saying, oh, I like that bit, I don't agree with that. You know that part of you that's always assessing. But the subconscious, what we would say is that every single experience leaves an impression on your subconscious. Who am I? I am actually the accumulation of millions of past experiences. And what Dr. Kubler-Ross says, and many others, and I would agree, from this life, from childhood, and even in past lives as well. And this is why emotion is often stored in little packages on my memory track, past experiences. Have you ever sometimes, someone says something pretty small or something happens, but the reaction in me is a huge, you know? This massive overreaction. And even afterwards we think, gosh, what happened? Why did I feel so... Because it's touched some experience from the past. And the nature of life, you know, is quite remarkable in that way. This person was telling me even one unusual story of a wealthy businessman in Australia who came to him with a really strange problem. That he has to travel a lot, mainly here to Europe. And when he's on an aeroplane, he can't go to the toilet. He can't have a pee. Now, Australia's a long way away. I don't know whether any of you... And over 20 hours without a pee is not very comfortable. He couldn't do it. He just couldn't do it. And so Peter is a hypnotherapist. So he took him under, you know, he explored that area. And what came out is that when this man was literally 19 years old, in the Second World War, he was in a submarine. And there was a boat above him that was, you know, dropping depth charges. And the captain of the submarine told all the men on the submarine, you can't go to the toilet. You can't go have a pee because the sonar will pick it up and they will know where the submarine is. And so they all had to sit there holding themselves. And isn't it amazing? He never registered. One incident of life carries over and affects other things. Now, this is the most tiny example of millions of things of your past which are overlaying your impression and your interpretation of life now. And that's why, you know, a part of the journey of dismantling powerful emotions is beginning to clean the memory track of these sorts of things. Because, you know, according to the understanding we have is that the soul always exists. The soul sits on the throne of the forehead and drives this amazing vehicle. But at some point this gets old or it doesn't work, it will leave and it will take another one. And you know, sometimes I have this sort of little thing that, you know, we're born and we say, this is my mum, this is my dad, this is my home, this is my country, these are my friends, and this is my career, these are my children, these are my achievements. You think of how you build up life, you know, the whole network. In a second, we leave it. We die. As we understand, the soul will almost instantly go back to the womb once again. It's born again. What does it do? This is my mum, this is my dad, this is my home. You know, we adopt the identity of the body, whereas the continuity through everything is I, the soul. Spirituality is enjoying life, loving my family, but knowing who I am amongst all this. Because most fear comes from the fear of loss of this body. And it's not so much even the death, I don't think, of the body, but it's actually letting go this identity I've spent a lifetime investing in. You know, I'm a beautiful musician. I've won these awards. I've had the children. I've got all this wealth. You know, this whole sense of self, which I've spent a lifetime creating, and the fear of losing that is a huge fear. And it's not just to make me feel good, but when I experience, not believe, experience the reality of self, I just see that I keep moving. My journey will continue. Wisdom is to enjoy it, but not hold on to it. And one of the analogies I really love is that, like, life is like a train journey. You know, when you're on a train, you stop at the station, and people hop on your train, people hop off. You go to the next station, people hop on, people hop off. And eventually, you know, the train keeps going, you hop off the train. This is life. People come into your life, people go out of your life. Possessions come into your life, possessions go out of your life. Accolades, responsibilities, whatever come into your life, they go. Everything, we can't ever own anything. And wisdom is to enjoy it, love it, but not say, I am this and you are mine. As soon as I'm saying I and this is mine, we will suffer. We will suffer because we will fear losing those particular things. And this is the, you know, I think, the attitude of a spiritual person, not just the belief, but we begin to live in this way. And I think it creates so, you know, helps me create peace of mind in that way. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross used to work with all these, you know, sorts of things. You know, even she researched it. We have so many people, even in just where I spend most of my time in Australia, so many people come to our centres who've had near-death experiences, you know. But, you know, they say they often don't tell people because people think they're stupid or something, you know. But they've had these experiences. It's quite, you know, it's not uncommon. I don't know. It's a few.
Hi. I have a question about something else. You were talking about that some people, their feelings, they're hiding their feelings. What about people that are very sensitive and they all the time want to show love and to be open, but they're getting hurt all the time and they still want to be open? So what the question is, what is your thoughts about people being sensitive? Is it the ego or is it the soul that wants to show love but the ego holds it back? Or how are you? What do you think?
You want to repeat the question?
No, I heard that one. Thank you. I would say there's a positive sensitivity and a negative sensitivity. You know, the positive sensitivity is almost an artistic sensitivity. You know, someone who's very sensitive to people and instantly can read people through their faces and vibrations, probably emotional intelligence, so you know how to respond. It's very positive. But the negative one, where I keep feeling hurt, it is ego. It is definitely ego. And some people often say, you know, I'm sensitive, like saying, don't hurt me. But, you know, I've got to sort of have the honesty that it's actually my ego. Only ego accepts sorrow. And in a sense, you know, the more I have self-respect, which to me is almost another name for the spiritual journey, rebuilding my sense of self. The external expression is humility. When you meet someone who's genuinely humble, I mean really a humble person, not bowing and scraping like a doormat, you know, that's not necessarily, there can be a lot of ego inside that, but they're humble. They don't accept sorrow from others. You know, sometimes I think most of us today have a PhD in accepting sorrow, you know, where we've become experts. If there's a sorrow to be, you know, experienced, I'll find it somewhere, you know. You know, sensitive nature is, we've just got to get over it in that way, because it's my ego that keeps taking insult and disrespect because of my own self-perception. And so there's the positive side of it, yes, but the negative side is a part of the spiritual journey. As I feel, you know, it's good to sometimes be with all different types of people and not be so fragile, you know, because usually those people who are blame the other people for hurting them, that is the ignorance that kicks in again. You know, they say in India, whenever you point the finger of blame, how many do you have pointing back at yourself? Three at least. I'm never sure quite where that one goes, but you know, you. And I think those on the spiritual journey take responsibility. If I'm sensitive, I've got to work with it. I think the lady was just here too. So.
Welcome to Denmark, Charlie.
Thank you.
I'm originally from Perth.
So, oh, are you? I can tell your accent, actually. Yeah.
You were talking about the soul as not having any width or breadth or height, just this little dot. But you also said it was a seed, or you used it as a seed in order to meditate. Could you explain this a little bit? Why are you talking about it as a seed? In which concept?
Yeah. You know, I suppose there's a lot of ideas that when you meditate, you know, meditate is to contemplate on deep things, because the soul exists, but it's not physical. And it's sometimes hard to get my thinking around. So perhaps, you know, something that exists. All of us, we're souls. I would say we sit near the front of the brain around the pituitary gland. I'm the consciousness that's driving this body. What is death when the soul separates? And I think in that way, it's almost like the soul, I'm just like an analogy, using it as, you know, it's a seed. Because within the seed is my whole history. And in a way, that's what I was just mentioning, that my whole past history is overlaying and my present and influencing my perception of everywhere. I remember once the French philosopher Rousseau said that everywhere man is born free, but everywhere he's found in chains. You know, ostensibly we're free, but the chains are my past actions, or the language of the East is my karma, my past karma, is like a overlaying my present experience of life. One of the aims of spirituality is to realize that it's my own actions disturbing my present, my past, so to clear that. So why do I meditate? One, to feel peace in the present. Two, to clear the backlog of the past. And three, to do quality action, sow the seeds of positive action for the future. So that it's like each thought that I generate is a seed of an action, and then the action leaves an impression. It's almost like I'm reprogramming my inner world in that way. Yeah. Pleasure. I think there's someone up the back who hasn't asked one yet. Then.
Those powerful emotions that we are talking about, are they just dissolving when we're meditating, or how do you suggest that we get rid of them? Because sometimes if a powerful emotion is in the body and I'm meditating, it just gets bigger and bigger, but it doesn't disappear. So can you answer this? How to really get rid of them? Because knowing that they're there and why they are there and giving love to them, yes, and meditating, yes, but how to really get rid of them?
You know, I think that the whole journey is definitely a process. My personal experience when I began to meditate was that the instant you feel a negative emotion like anger, you know, your heart will beat, or you know how physiologically the emotion translates into the body. But it's all coming from the soul, the consciousness. And I found that the more you practice being soul conscious, the less those feelings begin to translate in the body. Because it's almost like we're withdrawing the original nature of the self. As I understand it, the original blueprint in the soul is pure. In time, as the soul moves, it collects rubbish, you know. And as I begin to meditate, I reconnect with that which is original, and the seeds of negative emotion slowly, slowly have less effect. It doesn't happen overnight, and it wouldn't be honest to say that. I feel some emotions you can change with understanding, just understanding. But some you'll need long-term meditation and self-attention to reprogram that response or behavior. And that's once again a part of the spiritual journey. I think some things change quickly and some things take time. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But they do change. They do change. Mm. Yes, please.
You've been talking mostly about dealing with negative, powerful emotions, but what would you say about dealing with very positive, powerful emotions? Sometimes they can be very overwhelming as well.
Yes. I think that they're wonderful, though, aren't they? If you're talking about the feelings of peace. You know, everything has layers and levels. My experience, you know, when we begin to meditate, we feel a bit calm. After a while, sometimes I think positive thinking makes you calm. As you become soul conscious, you feel peace. But as I think you develop the relationship with the Supreme Soul, it's almost like an inner silence, this wonderful inner silence, which is so rejuvenating. And it's a silence from negativity, and it's a silence from waste. It's almost like there's just a purity, you know, you reconnect with that purity. It's so beautiful. And perhaps sometimes we're not used to big doses of these things, and it can be a little bit overwhelming. But I think, what is meditation? Meditation is taking these ideas and massaging them into my feelings. Meditation is taking the theory and experiencing it. You know, because I think so much of life today, we're so cerebral, we're all in our head. We believe things and we quote it to others, but we don't experience them. And I think when I begin to think I'm a peaceful soul, I realize I'm a peaceful soul, I experience the depth of peace, you know? And that's the education of meditation, to transform a knowing and believing into an experience of peace, of love, of power, all these qualities. And I would say, the more I rebuild that in myself, because the seeds are there of that, it's just been forgotten, it's just like dormant, the effect of negative emotion becomes less and less. And that's why I'm tending to feel in my life these days, rather than focusing on the negative and how to deal with it, focus on the positive to grow it, and almost automatically the negative has less power over me. And I would say the most powerful thing is love, and that's why when I meditate on this relationship with the Supreme Soul, and I give myself permission to be loved, deeply loved, I think that is the seed of so much positive energy within myself. And often when people talk to me about meditation, I often feel, just try to experiment with the experience of pure love, because that's the seed, I feel, of taking back all my self-respect and all my power once again. Maybe there's time for one more question, and perhaps we should have some meditation, because I know that you don't want to be too late, am I right? I didn't get much response to that. But anyone? Actually, she wanted to ask another question. So maybe you can be the last one.
I was just thinking, I don't know if it's a stupid question, but I sometimes attract people with problems all the time, and I was thinking if it's because I have problems or because of my feelings, or it's just the energy, I don't know.
Maybe you're a very nice person and people just... you make people comfortable. You know, And really, I think it's some of truth in what I say, because people only reveal their inner world when they trust. So maybe people feel naturally to trust you, to speak openly to you. So maybe it's a blessing. The thing is, though, I think we have to learn not to be influenced by people's stuff. Because if people see we're affected by it, you're not so able to help them in that way. It's a way of being empathetic to people's issues and not getting emotionally involved in them. I think that's a real wisdom, to be able to do that. You know, today I feel it's not so much what you say, it's your attitude. I think, you know, maybe I'm exaggerating, but I think life is so challenging for most people today, and people, the inner world is in so much upheaval for so many people, that just a face which is respecting, is loving, is kind, is listening, just your face does wonders, you know? Because sometimes people don't want to hear ideas, they're just over information or advice, but just your smile even. I don't think we can underestimate, you know, what you can convey through your face and your feelings. It's very powerful. And to me, you know, we give emotional support to friends and family, but I would say spiritual support is just, you know, having faith in them that they will get through their issue. You know, you hold that faith, and just your faith in them can help them. I remember one of my friends, he started his meditation journey along with me. He described himself, I mean, he called himself the most negative person in the world. Now, that's a big statement. But what he was saying was that he used to go up and down hugely. And the meditation center he went to, the person running it saw his value. And no matter how down he got, she refused to buy into it. She saw something of potential in him. That's where her vision fell, and it's like he stepped into that place, you know. And I feel you can't underestimate. It's like with children, you know, who go through their stuff. If you hold their value, you know their potential, and you hold that, just your sense of faith can help them move forward. So I'm sure people tell you their problems because you have a kind face. Okay, shall we maybe wind up there? And I think as is the tradition, we're just going to have a little bit of meditation. And I'm going to make a suggestion. I think perhaps many of you have meditated with the Brahma Kumaris. Can I ask who has done meditation with the Brahma Kumaris before? Well, basically everybody. Can I just suggest for these few moments that if you sit comfortably, your feet on the ground, and maybe put things down that you're holding. If you feel comfortable, keep your eyes open and gently rest your vision towards this image of light. Why eyes open? You know, once I was the guinea pig at an experiment in California at the University of San Francisco, University of California at San Francisco, and there was a scientist studying meditation. And it's a proven fact, meditators can calm themselves down. It's a factual thing that meditators have less hospital and doctor visits than people, you know, your regular people, but they do still have hospital and doctor visits. Her interest was, when you meditate, you can cool your inner world down, but when you go out there, you know, in work and family and relationship issues, does it still work? You know, do you carry your meditation into life? Which I think is what we want, isn't it? We want to make it real in our life. So I was one of her guinea pigs, and I had to sit in this little room. I think I was there for 6 hours, and she put electrodes all over me. And first, she asked me to meditate and recorded my brain waves. Then she asked me to sleep, and that's something I'm quite good at. So I slept for a little while. And then she gave me all these problems to do, you know, mathematical problems. And I had to give her answers with a certain time. She was trying to put me under pressure like a working day. What she said was her research shows that when people meditate with their eyes open, the effect of meditation is carried into your relationships, your work, and your life. In other words, your spiritual life's connecting with your day-to-day life. It's not a disconnect there. And I think it's a really important thing. And at first, we're so used to what I see dominating my mind, but ultimately, a meditator creates the thoughts and just observes through the eyes. And it's like a wonderful practice. And that's why we suggest, if you meditate with your eyes open, any time you can have a few minutes of meditation and constantly center yourself. So we're going to play a little bit of music. And excuse me. Let me just sit quietly. And with a gentle determination, just keep attention to the thoughts being suggested. Internally, I have a huge world with so many thoughts, so many powerful feelings. How do I negotiate this complex world? To cool down my inner world. And enjoy the power of peace. The first step is to experience my true self. Just visualize in the eye of your mind this tiny star in the center of the forehead, in the front of the brain. This is I, the soul, the permanent self. It is a wonder how I, the conscious soul, act through this body, look through the eyes, hear through the ears. But in meditation, I'm going to let it all go. And just feel yourself letting go the consciousness of the body. Just relax, withdraw. Just feel yourself withdrawing to this point in the forehead. I, the eternal soul, the immortal self. Just keep holding your focus to this tiny point. Keep letting go. Feel so light in your forehead. The more I step back from the consciousness and the image of my body, the deeper the feelings of peace begin to emerge. I am a peaceful soul. In meditation, I'm re-establishing my eternal identity. And in this soul-conscious state, let me reunite with the lover of the soul. Just sit in front of this radiant jewel of light. This is not a concept or a belief, but a real living soul that's ever pure. This is the one relationship that's always there. Just move towards this light, this orb of light, the Supreme Soul. This supreme amongst all souls is an unlimited source of love. Just feel the energy of love fill you. Just feel this love entering the core of your being. Just allow yourself to be completely loved. And just feel the deep joy and self-respect that emerges. Yoga is a union of I, the soul, with the lover, the supreme soul. If each morning I wake and I sit quietly and become self-conscious and reconnect with the lover of the soul, the healing begins. The power of emotion starts to lessen. I take back my self-authority. To meditate regularly is an act of love for myself.